Welcome to another edition of Cover to Cover, and I have two amazing guests in this edition, which I cannot wait to get stuck into. We have a book by Chrisanta Bade, who is a journalist in this country that have had many positions in broadcasting as well as in print, and he has written this book, Hack with a Grenade. I think a book that really should do better than it has done thus far, and by the time you've listened to my interview with him, I'm sure you will agree. The second book is a very different book. We very often don't think about the status of animals other than ourselves in this country. I had the pleasure of also interviewing Helena Creel about Meditating with Rhinos, her second book, which is absolutely beautifully written. But we kick off this edition by having a look at a conversation I have recorded with Chrisanta Bade about this beautiful book of his experiences as a newspaper man. Chrisanta, thank you so much for being in conversation with me here on Cover to Cover, and congratulations on what was really an absolutely fantastic read.
I appreciate that, and high praise coming from you, Eusebius. As you know, I'm a big fan of your work, so that means a lot.
Always been generous since I met you, and I really appreciate that. But I'm being just sincere. I am brutally honest with book reviews. And if I had to describe this book, let's both describe it. For me, I would say, Chrisanta, I'm not sure what you set out to achieve in terms of intention, but someone might pick up this book and think this is probably a book for journalists and aspiring journalists. I would disagree with them. This is a book written by a seasoned journalist about stories on his beat as a journalist and as an editor. But each chapter, as I said to my co-host Joanne Joseph, is so beautifully observed in terms of the people that Chrisanta has written about, that actually each of the chapters becomes social and political commentary about Cape Town and ultimately about South Africa. And in that sense, it's a book for any person who is engaged on questions of identity, race, marginalization, apartheid spatial planning, misogyny within the world of business and sport. It is thematically very wide-ranging, even though the golden thread is journalism. Chrisanta, what did you set out to achieve? Is that a decent summary of the intention behind the book?
I think that's spot on, Eusebius. So journalism is used as that thread, as that device to tell a story about South Africa, really. And it's very personal to me because a lot of these stories, I have to immerse myself into these stories and the characters that I use to tell a South African story. So, I mean, I tackle things about identity and my own identity as a colored a man working in the media space and some of the challenges there, but also the kind of conversations we're having about identity in South Africa, you know, and race identity. But then there's also these things that are creeping into everyday life, like gentrification. The issue about missing children, for example, and crime and how we treat that, you know, we kind of shorthand over these things. And through the characters that I had met over the years. Now, very importantly also, if I had to be the type of editor that sat in an office waiting for things to happen, I wouldn't have been able to write this book. So the book is also about journalism, about groundbreaking journalism, absolutely, and about doing things differently, you know, and innovating in the space.
Well, let's give some examples of a couple of the chapters. You must go out and buy this book. I recommend it highly. Hack with a Grenade. You can find it at bookstores across the country. Chapter 2, Danny and the Invisible People. One of the most heartwarming stories that Chrisanta tells is not just an issue of race, but also an issue of class, how we render certain people invisible. If you are watching this interview online, chances are you are not a homeless person. And that is why the story of Danny Chrisanta is so, so important. In a nutshell, what is chapter 2 about?
Okay, so chapter 2, I had from the outset of meeting Danny, this homeless guy who really brought to life a what could have been a very mundane series on homeless people in a daily newspaper. You know, it's the kind of content that people roll their eyes at, because what content on homeless people are you going to do that hasn't been done before? But with Danny being able to write and tell his lived experience, we brought the issue of homelessness to life in a daily newspaper for at least 3 weeks, and then 3 years after that, until he passed away, unfortunately, early last year. But my ulterior motive is, how can we have How can we do sincere storytelling in a newsroom where we still have prejudices about race, about homosexuality, about HIV/AIDS? And Danny was all of that. You know, he was a homeless guy, he was white, he was gay, and he was HIV positive. So I wanted to put him next to the reporters so that they could start stripping away their own prejudices.
And they had to,
he
because
also
he
came
was
into the newsroom.
Right? He was interesting, he had dreams, he had a life narrative, he was literate, he could write, so much so that you put him on the front page, in fact. I don't know if anyone can see that clearly, maybe not with the thing that I have here, so I'll read it out to you. The front page of the Cape Argus on the 11th of April in 2016, and that was a quote, an excerpt from him in the first person, which I think was also fantastic because then you get his subjectivity across, and it says, "I'm just like you, but I'm homeless." If you pick up the Cape Argus on that day, Chasant, you can't, again, at least not without taking responsibility for your lack of empathy, you could never again be indifferent towards a homeless person on the promenade or at the next robot.
No, exactly. And the thing is, I like what you say there about Danny being more than the sum of his parts or his circumstances that brought him to where he was in that time. And he's a reminder to all of us that we're one paycheck away from being homeless. I mean, that's the reality for most South Africans, you know? Yeah. And the thing with Danny is he's got a worldview. He came to sit in our conferences, and the contributions he made through his eyes were very telling. He was very well read. He understood what was going on in the world and in society. But at the same time, he didn't take anything for granted. So I would walk around the newsroom, and there Danny'd be would be doing an online journalism course, you know, trying to improve himself. The kind of things we, the homed, in inverted commas, take for granted.
Yeah.
You know, and here's a homeless man grabbing every opportunity he possibly could. Yeah.
Let's take a completely different chapter and give people another taste of the book and how journalism allows you to observe society and not just to archive what is happening, but also to really, really do some substantive social and political commentary. You make a remarkable claim on page 85, and it goes as follows. 5 years on, I look back at that student co-edited edition of Cape Argus and hold it up as my finest moment as a newspaper editor, and perhaps my entire career in journalism. Now, you started your journalism career at the age of 19 when you're doing an internship. So for you to make that claim in your early 40s, late 30s, is a gigantic claim to make. We've spoken about homeless people. There's another ill in society the world over, and it's ageism. Old people think they can learn little from young people. And very often, young people think old people gifted us an imperfect world. They must shut up. What is it about the fees must fall moment that was so, so fascinating for you as an editor when you responded to a challenge from Gus Silber?
So on that age note, I'll settle for late 30s, Eusebius, if you don't mind at all. But to be honest with you, it all happened by accident. And again, Gus Silber was that kind of catalyst to our consciousness on social media. And he said, is there any editor out there who will take up the challenge to allow students to run the newspaper for the day? I forget the exact wording, but without thinking, I took up the challenge. And then I found myself in real trouble because where were we going to find the students on a practical level to bring out an edition in the next couple of hours for the following day? And then that became a backstory in its own right, how we found those students. But more than that, I think they took me by surprise. You know, I remember saying on the day that this wasn't your mommy's Cape Argus because the students were obviously complaining that the traditional news media was not giving them the voice that they would to the minister and the universities and the vice chancellors. All the players except the student voice was coming through, with a few notable exceptions like Daily Vox. Khadija Patel's outfit did amazing work at the time, you know. So here was an opportunity for the students to have their own space where they chose their own headlines, captions, images, and their own stories, their own diaries. And I was kind of at their mercy as well because I am accountable for that newspaper. If they say something that's defamatory, I'm the guy that's going to get sued. But it was a leap of faith. in order to win their trust, I had to do something bold, you know, and it paid off. It was a gamble, make no mistake about it. And because I had committed very publicly to give the space. But what I learned from these students was they, contrary to popular belief, they're not lazy. They are actually critical thinkers. They're not apathetic, but they are very important to activism and to the national discourse in this country, you know, and they showed us.
Yeah.
They showed us how they started very peacefully.
With you, Hassant, which is also important because very often the lazy critics of the students were on some, these are the kind of students who probably just want an easy pass on their careers and also discount on marks, et cetera, et cetera. Many of them went on to get cum laude degrees in areas like, for example, theater, and many of them are flourishing post-university and trying to take that fight further in the corporate world as well. So also the assumption that it must be the weaker, academically weaker students that are busy with a toy toy on UCT campus, that proved to not be the case. I mean, your chief sub-editor, you know, was chuffed at the clean copy that was given ahead of time. So it was also interesting how you had to intellectually, collectively humble yourselves to the brain power of the students rather than seeing them just as an amorphous, anti-intellectual, lazy bunch.
Yeah, no, that took me completely by surprise without me sounding patronizing. I didn't expect the kind of skill that they were bringing to the table. It was immense. It was leadership in action, you know. And, you know, there's always this idea, or it's a truism, that you can't edit a newspaper by democracy. But in this instance, the students proved that whole notion wrong, you know. And for maybe it was a fluke, but in one instance, absolutely, there is a case where there was a democratic editing of a newspaper. And you mentioned students involved. So Amira Conrad, he graduated cum laude in drama, in BA, and she drama as a major. And she went on to co-direct and write and in The Fall, which was an acclaimed theater production on the Fees Must Fall movement that ran at the Baxter Theater and other places all over the world as well. So, and then Brian Kamanga is also one of the student leaders that was involved in. Is a very smart guy, you know. I don't know if you follow him on social media. He is next level, you know, leadership.
Lastly, just in the 2 minutes we have left, just to give them a final taste, and we'll bring it back to journalism. Ramona thought she had found Jesus in the toilet. That's a lacquer first chapter because it is a compelling story to tell. But beyond that, very often middle-class South Africans, black and white, and other colors in between, are very condescending when it comes to the way we respond to mass media that focuses on the poorest of the poor. So we are intrigued by the success of the Daily Sun or on television of Mojalove as a TV channel. But very briefly, what is it about tabloidization that on the one hand can be bad for journalism, but on the other hand, when you think about your time at Daily Voice, there is some critically important lessons to be learned for mainstream media from where tabloids fit into the lives of poor people.
So it's very important, the ordering of the chapters, and they're very deliberate as well, because it also talks about my journey, you know, going from the Daily Voice into the more serious newspapers as I graduated, you know, became an older guy, I suppose, with a receding hairline. But the idea is that, you know, tabloid journalism really get to the bread and butter issues. And we often take these things for granted, but that's the real politics that affect people. It's not identity politics when Julius Malema says something crazy or the president says something. That's not necessarily politics for ordinary South Africans. If somebody's dumping on a football field in an area like Lavender Hill on the Cape Flats, that's the politics that affects ordinary South Africans. And that's where the tabloid journalism's journalism and tabloid newspapers and platforms do so well. They're able to campaign. They're able to do advocacy journalism that go to the heart of the fabric of our communities, you know. And it's the kind of things that the traditional newspapers often gloss over, you know. They don't pay attention to the real issues that affect people. And we kind of live up here. We report here. When the real issues are really very much down here, you know, and that's the important gap. And I almost want to say that I want to challenge the fact that the tabloids are actually the mainstream, and it's the mainstream papers that are actually on the fringes, you know.
Absolutely beautifully put. I want another opportunity for us to have a longer conversation, maybe with a live audience, because I think this book deserves that. And there's so much more to tease out in chapters I had not mentioned. But in the meantime, I would strongly encourage you to buy a copy of Hack with a Grenade. And that is by Hassan Tabada. Really, really, really delightful lead. Hassan, congratulations, and thanks so much for being part of the conversations today.
Thanks, Eusebius.
Thank you so much to Hassan for recounting stories from journalism that illuminate social and political issues in our country. Next up is a book that some of you might not want to look at, but I reckon you should take a chance on it, Meditating with Rhinos. This is my interview with Helena Krill about her relationship with these fascinating animals.
Helena, congratulations on the new book and welcome to Cover to Cover.
Thanks, Eusebius. Lovely to be with you.
You've got a deep love for non-human animals. Where does that come from?
You know, Eusebius, my mother grew up without money. And so what landed up happening in her childhood is that her parents would take them into the wild. And I think a deep love seeded itself in my mother for the natural world. It wasn't something you had to pay for, but you had access to beauty, you had access to vitality. So it went into her imaginatively, and she took it forward, and that's who she was as a mother. And we grew up as young kids with that same person informing us, what does the tree look like? What does the sky look like? What do the leaves look like? And then, of course, it went further and went into the animal world. What does the lizard look like? And then we had dogs growing up. And so it was just like that. It was the natural world equaled beauty.
That's absolutely
And
stunning. I love that. Yeah. And in fact, those animals, even at your home, were always part of the landscape, which is really interesting. I want you to go to page 35 of this beautiful book of yours and read a scene that captures precisely what you have just said, which is how this is not just a Helena relationship with other animals, it is really a love that the whole family always had. That was instilled in, imbued within all the children as well. Read for us, Helena.
okay, so chapter 7 is called Soft Breathing. A tiny vervet monkey is curled around my neck like a scarf. I lie in my sister's room in a spare bed in our family home in Johannesburg. The vervet's face is pressed up against mine, and she breathes peacefully into my ear, her arms encircling my neck, sleeping. I lie awake in this dark room. I don't want to sleep. I don't want to waste a moment of this. There are soft crates made up for nighttime sleeping, but the plaintive weeping of these babies looking for their mother's care has torn into us, and we've decided to give them our love, our arms, and comfort for the two brief nights that they're with us. I have scored the peaceful monkey. My sister Lexi is lying awake in her bed with her tiny vervet biting her nose and pinching her ear. She scored the demon. Ow, ow, she groans. She struggles up trying to find a bottle of milk because maybe that will help. I lie in the bliss of my sleeping angel's bliss. Remember this, I think, remember this. Lexi rehabilitates animals. She's a renowned chef, but she works with bats, vervets, owls, pangolins, and all kinds of wild, injured baby birds. She's just reared five Lurie fledglings. Only one and two have remained here. Two is now Tutu, and she thinks she's a person. And one is now Hoppy on account of the fact that she hops. Hoppy doesn't care that she has bad feet. She just hops from point A to point B. The birds are sleeping in my room. and I'm sleeping in my sister's room, and we will have monkey madness all weekend.
I love it. Absolutely love it. It's absolutely gorgeous. Your book is not didactic, and that's a good thing. You are not speaking at readers that do not have the same relationship with animals as you and your family has. Your book is recounting and presenting that relationship, and it is for the reader to experience your world from your subjective viewpoint and to do with that as they might please. But I want to take that material and talk to you about the status of animals. And I want you to speak to potential readers and to South Africans, international citizens watching this conversation between you and me, who do have a hierarchy, explicitly or implicitly, when it comes to life on planet Earth, and who think that human beings, perhaps in virtue of consciousness, complex language, the ability to reflect before we act intentionally, somehow have a moral status that put us at the apex of the animal kingdom. Your relationship in this book shows that you regard animals as having a different kind of moral status in relation to us as human beings. Meditate for me on that particular point and what you regard as the proper status that animals should have in our view of them.
Gosh, Eusebius, what a beautiful question. We have relegated animals to creatures who are beneath us, below us. But we've taken it a step further, is we've relegated them to background. So we live now in the foreground of our reality, with everything in the natural world relegated to background. And we have a passive relationship with this. It doesn't impact us. We are not in love with it. We don't recognize it. We don't see it as potential relationship. Mm. And as a result of that, our world has diminished. We are very human-centric, and our relationship is with other human beings. And we live in this extraordinary place with such beauty surrounding us. And our animals and our nature, our trees, our birds, the moon, whatever, the clouds in the sky, is all there for us to engage with, for us to have relationship with. My view is that if we claim that relationship, we can have a very vital, a very colorful, a much sweeter life than we have if we just concentrate on the relationships we have with other humans. And also, you know, it's technology now that's impacting everything. So all relationship is now through the cold screen as well. Mm. So everything's becoming sort of colder and more at a distance. I think we're robbing ourselves, honestly. I think we're robbing ourselves of what it really is to be humans, and what it is to have relationship, and what it is to be in love, and what it is to be vital. I think that the more that we engage with everything, the more human we are, the more colorful our lives are, and the more vital we are. And why should we rob ourselves? That's how I see it.
What do you say to your readers or folks that might watch this conversation who've got a different positionality in terms of how they think about ecology? And they might say to you, I'm not against animals having minimal set of rights, such as the right and the moral entitlement not to be harmed. However, when it comes down to it, one should prioritize limited resources, for example, and limited time towards the needs of fellow human beings. Rhino are particularly emotionally divisive animals in South Africa, and a book like yours is fantastic. Some people watching this or seeing the cover of your book in bookstores might roll their eyes and go, oh, there we go again. Another white woman who thinks that rhino matter more than black people. Let's confront that reality. What do you say to someone for whom that thought surfaces?
You know what I say to that, Eusebius, is we all have a right to belong. Belonging is a fundamental right as a living creature. Doesn't the rhino have a right to belong, eating its grass, eating its trees? Don't we have a right to belong in a house where we say, this is my home, with a person that we say, this is my partner? Why should we rob each other of belonging? So it's a universal right, black, white, old, young, human, animal. We have a right to belong. And who are we to take away that right from each other? Mm-hmm. You know, if we're taking away the right of a rhino to belong, then it's a quick thing to take away the rights of the person that you're living with. Sure. You know, what is your right to belong? Who are you? Explain your rights to me. Mm-hmm. So that's how I see it, is it's not about privilege. It's not about white, black, male, female. It's about the universal right to be alive and to say, I belong to my life, to who I am.
We're not going to give away the entire structure of the book because this interview is too short for my liking. It's such a rich book. I want you to go and buy the book. It's at Exclusive Books. Go get a copy, Meditating with Rhinos. But essentially, we start in the States. Helena comes back to South Africa, and she needs a respite from human love that sometimes can go south. And she finds part of that respite outside Kruger, where she looks after, with folks who've been doing this for a long time, rhino that gets hacked, especially baby rhino, whose moms sometimes get poached by poachers for their horns. And the heart of the story is about that experience. That's all I'm going to give you by way of a précis, because I want to jump to a particular scene in the book that I want to read from on page 94, where a feisty woman who is running this particular rehabilitation camp is in conversation with Helena on a point that speaks to what Helena had just spoken to. And it goes as follows, and they're meditating here on the place of rhino horns culturally in some societies. She lets that settle, the absurdity and tragedy of it. I mean, tiger penis, rhino horn, even though there's nothing in the ancient Chinese medicine to say it cures anything, the Vietnamese believe it helps cancer, and the Chinese say it cures everything you can think of. Cancer, indigestion, sea snake bites. Sea snake bites, I say. Who gets bitten by a sea snake? The rhino horn, it's a fucking tonic of note. It lets you have good sex, and you can drink more and cure your hangovers faster. This is their thinking. Emma walks in, followed by a volunteer. Kom, Emma, the volunteer says, holding out a melon rind. Kom, hello, my girl, Petronelle says, and Emma waddles over, decorated with long strands of slimy weed that patterns her in green stripes. You are not judgmental, even while wanting us to rethink the status of animals and to accept that sentience is sufficient basis to have equal regard for all animals, and that having human language and consciousness should not be a criteria required before we have moral regard for an animal. In that exchange, you do not judge human cultures that have particular belief systems. Speak to me into that, because on the one hand, we're not going to put an end to poaching unless we confront false beliefs. And on the other hand, appropriately, you are also deeply respectful sociologically of how certain beliefs play out in the lives of persons. And as you rightly point out, we can't take the moral high ground ourselves, because we also have lots of beliefs in our own belief system that sometimes are false or anti-scientific.
You know, I think that when you're causing harm, there needs to be a pause. You know, if you think about diamonds that are very much considered to be something that one aspires to as a Western person, black diamonds are problematic because people get harmed in mining those diamonds. So if you are looking at the diamond as something that potentially has caused harm, there needs to be a moment where you say, all right, do I know that this has been gotten carefully? Am I okay with this reflecting my culture, my value system? I think that it's about no harm. To me, that's the thing. You know, we're very different in our cultural beliefs as human beings. But let us have no harm. Let us have a philosophy of as little harm as possible.
Thank you so much to both of my authors for today's show. If you want to know where you can get hold of their books, go to any exclusive books outlet in the country. You can also go online to exclusivebooks.co.za. And remember, if you want to be keeping abreast of more shows in future, you can follow me on my social media platforms or Joanne Joseph, my fellow presenter in this series. And also, you can have a look at previous interviews we've done with book authors by going to the YouTube page of Exclusive Books, where all of these episodes of Cover to Cover have been archived. Until our next episode, enjoy your reading.